And the verse we hope will guide our thinking here this day, once again, 1 Chronicles 12 and 32, which says, hopefully, of many in our generation, of Issachar, men of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, 200 chiefs and all their kinsmen under their command. And today we once again are taking up how should Christians respond to Islam? Question that every Christian, every church should be asking of its people as well. Not pretending there's nothing out there. Not copping out by saying all we have to do is preach the gospel, because we preach the gospel every day, and how we respond to issues around us, our culture around us. Let me give you some true and false questions here as we look at six phases of response, six different kinds of responses the Christian should have toward Islam. Let me ask you, true or false, the Quran teaches tolerance and peace. The Quran teaches tolerance and peace. Sure, there's a few bad verses here and there, but there are also a lot of verses that affirm the brotherhood of man, the equality and dignity of all people, right? No. Yeah, false. The Quran does have some verses that counsel tolerance or peaceful coexistence. For example, in conversion, the Quran, Surah number 2, verse 256 says, "Let there be no compulsion in religion." This is one of the favorites of Muslim apologists. "Let there be no compulsion in religion. Truth stands out clear from error. Muhammad says, whoever rejects evil and believes in Allah hath grasped the most trustworthy handhold that never breaks," unquote, from the Quran, Surah number 2. Now, if it weren't for the doctrine of abrogation, that is, later verses abrogate in principle earlier verses, this might be true. And there are many Muslims who do, at least initially. And Osama bin Laden, in a sermon before 9/11, so graciously bid Americans to convert to Islam. They are required first, before they slit your throat, to bid you to come to Islam and do so peacefully. But after that, no guarantees. No holds barred in bringing on then jihad. So that question is false. Number two, Islam's war teachings, then, Pastor, are only a tiny element of that religion, right? Only a tiny element. Even if the Quran does contain some verses about war, that doesn't mean Muslims agree with them, right? After all, there are a lot of Christians who don't take every aspect of Christian doctrine seriously out there. Well, of course, there, yes, many Christians do not take doctrine seriously at all either. And there are some Muslims who, because the Quran is only in Arabic, and most Muslims today, oddly enough, are not Arabic. The vast number, over a billion Muslims in the world, and only a tiny fraction of them really are Arabic anymore. Most Muslims are ignorant of their faith in many degrees. And the jihadist, the non-jihadist, the peaceful, tolerant Muslim, is a lukewarm Muslim. That you must understand as well. When a Muslim asked Muhammad to name the best deed that one could do besides becoming a Muslim, Muhammad responded, "To participate in jihad in Allah's cause. To guard Muslims from infidels in Allah's cause, for one day is better than the world and whatever is on its surface," he said. He also goes on to say, "A journey undertaken for jihad in the evening or morning merits a reward better than the world and all that is in it." You must understand that the average Muslim is still in danger of hellfire, Muhammad says. And the only by doing the good deeds and being a good Muslim, he still stands in danger of hellfire, because who knows when you've done enough? That's the insecurity of a works-based righteousness, isn't it? We've seen that time and time again in all the world's religions. Well, it's so true in Islam as well. What is the guaranteed way then to get to heaven? One of his disciples asked him that, and he said, accept Allah as Lord, Islam as his religion, and Muhammad as his apostle is necessarily entitled to enter paradise. Messenger of Allah, repeat it for me. He says, there is another act, Muhammad says, which elevates the position of a man in paradise to a grade 100 grades higher. And the elevation between one grade and the other is equal to the height of the heaven from the earth. What is that? The disciple asked him. He replied, jihad in the way of Allah. Jihad in the way of Allah. It is the one way guaranteed then to get you to paradise. Well, so that one is false as well. It is in fact a myth. Third myth, and I only have four here. I have a dozen for my radio spot, but number three then. What is this, true or false? Islam is a religion of peace that's been hijacked by a tiny minority of extremists. And this is, we hear this ad nauseum, don't we? Ad nauseum in the media today. And Robert Spencer says, this is the mother of all PC myths about Islam. Its persistence, though, and resilience in the face of mountains of evidence is then indeed to the contrary. This is the course of Islam. The myth is Islam is a religion of the peace that will come eventually. Indeed, there is a peace inculcated. Sayyid Qutb, one of the founding fathers of the Muslim Brotherhood, says it is a peace that will come when everyone is Muslim, or at least subject to the Islamic State. And to establish that peace, Muslims must wage war. So that is the kind of peace that most Muslims have in mind when they talk about peace, about genuine shalom. Well, what about moderate Muslims, though, Mr. Smarty Pants, Pastor? Isn't the world filled with moderate Muslims and with peaceful Muslims who only want to get along? Well, yeah, as I said before, these are then the lukewarm Muslims. Fourth myth that is current about Islam, and this is popular even among conservatives, is that what Islam needs is a reformation. What Islam needs is a reform that's akin to the reformation of the 16th century in Christendom, right? To change it, to transform it, to make it more peaceful and more tolerant. Well, all I can say to that is there's already been a reformation in the last century. Once again, check out Sayyid Qutb, who lived for 2 years here in the Midwest. He traveled around Kansas. He lived in Kansas for a while, lived in Colorado for a while, but lived in middle-class homes as he attended a variety of schools, and said America was the most decadent and corrupt society and culture on the face of the earth. And that was in the 50s, right? When I was growing up, and that was the America of my grandpa and grandma. What if he saw the America of today? But in any case, he was one of the inspirations, one of the intellectual and spiritual inspirations for the Muslim Brotherhood. And you need to look at the Muslim Brotherhood, because they have been to the White House over 40 times in consultation with our president as he plans strategy for the Middle East, whether it's Egypt or Syria. So, Reformation has already transpired, and we're seeing the fruits of that reformation now, today, in ISIS, in terrorism, in the violence we see all around us. That is a reformed Islam, and that if you're looking for that, you've already got it, all right? So conservatives need to get over that aspiration for a reformation of Islam. Well, how do we respond to this as it becomes increasingly aggressive and militant? The recent Muslim attacks in San Bernardino and Orlando are exhibit A for us. Prompted, one of the things that helped to prompt this series for myself. How is this progressive agenda to appease Muslims working? Has being nice and tolerant to Islam brought us peace and understanding? Because we have opened the floodgates of Muslim immigration, are we safer, more loved and respected by Muslims, more united and integrated as a society? And of course, no. The obvious answer is no. In fact, if we know anything about Islam, it is that all of our appeals to appeasement and understanding and mutual respect and tolerance are seen as weakness by a religion that only understands force and strength. It's how Islam grew as a worldwide religion and how it's growing today too. In Islam, there is no middle ground, no common center for mutual understanding. There are two houses in Islam. There is the Dar al-Islam, that is the house of Islam, true Muslims. And even then they fight over who is a true Muslim or not, right? And then there is the Dar al-Harb, that is the house of war. And that's all the rest of us, okay? And you're either one or the other. There's no gray. And if you're of the house of war, then you are the object of eternal hostility until you either, there are one of three options in Islam. And they lay low, right? They're on the down low until they get the numbers and the strength to assert themselves. But when they do, and they call the shots, as they do across the Middle East today, you either convert to Islam, or you become a dhimmi, which is a shamed, subjugated, despised, and severely taxed minority in Muslim society, or you die. One of three options. So, do we understand our options, deluded Americans? It'll never touch us, though, Pastor. It'll never touch us. I talked to a family from a Middle Western city, and they are surrounded now incrementally, gradually over the years. They find themselves in a Muslim neighborhood now, and they're trying to be very tactful about it, but they understood the oppression they were under as well, that there had been several rapes in their community because of girls and women that Muslims just felt that they could take because they weren't dressed modestly, and that therefore they were ripe for the pickings. And this is happening with increasing frequency in America. And they were considering moving here as well. So don't be deluded. You will be confessing Allah as God and Muhammad as his prophet rather than Jesus is Lord here very soon, unless we do respond as we should. How then should the Christian respond to Islam in its current state, its current iteration? Now, I give you six ways in which to respond, three of which we detailed last week, right? First of all, you remember from last week, the Christian must respond with the truth of Christ. There's no sense in taking the edge off or hiding the truth of Christianity. You'll only give up the ship and fall faster. Islam is not a companion religion to Christianity. Islam and Christianity do not have shared truths to serve as common ground. Yahweh of the Bible and Allah of the Quran are not different names and revelations of the same deity. We saw this last week. Indeed, Allah was one of 360 gods of the Quraysh tribe from which he originated, and in his return then from his exile in Medina, when he returned then to Mecca, he cleansed the Kaaba. The temple of the Kaaba, the Kaaba stone, cleansed them of the other 259 and just selected Allah as his favorite and said, this is Allah, God of gods, and I am his prophet. So we must respond with the truth of Christ, and Islam is not the truth of Christ and bears no truth of Christ. Secondly, the Christian must respond with the love of Christ as well. And these are not contradictory. We can do both of these things. We can defend ourselves and love the Muslim at the same time. There is no mutual exclusivity about it. There's no absolutism about any of the principles that we find in Scripture. It depends, once again, on the covenant under which they fall. Ultimately, Muslims are lost sinners. We must retain this compassion, this love for lost sinners, like the vast majority of mankind. Even in the midst of their savage butchery, Muslims can be humbled to see the love of God. We see examples of this across the world. God shows his love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Our brothers and sisters here, Stuart and Taryn, will be facing some of this if they return to Uganda. There are large Muslim populations across Africa. We are obligated to show the love of Christ in word and deed to all, wherever and however possible. Pray for wisdom for Stuart and Taryn to know, indeed, when they should respond with what response. When we are persecuted, slain, reviled, we are to nevertheless love those who are our enemies. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. But is this the only and exclusive response to Islam that we should have? Some make this the absolute response in every case, but this is not biblical wisdom, because we saw last week, of course. Thirdly, the Christian must respond with the appropriate self-defense. An important segment. I spent a lot of time on it because it's so misunderstood. So many Christians are ill-informed regarding their Second Amendment and self-defense. We observe, for example, that every Christian action can be guided for direction depending upon the covenant under which it falls. Once again, if you don't understand covenant, you don't understand the Bible, and you will not know when to respond with the appropriate biblical response. There are four great covenants: the covenant of creation, which we find the dominion mandate to be fruitful, fill the earth, take dominion of it. There is the marriage covenant, in which we find fruitful companionship, helpmates for our lives. And then we have the covenant of redemption and grace. We're here today worshiping under that beautiful covenant, the covenant of grace and redemption, in which God gave to his Son a people, the church, in which we find salvation by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. And then there is finally the civil covenant, in which we order our lives here on this temporal sphere, in this world, under God, by governing ourselves according to his will. And we are intended to do that, the civil covenant, four great covenants. Once again, I recommend to you GaryNorth.com/covenants.pdf. And you'll find these covenants. Once again, he has different terminology, different nomenclature, but basically the same covenants that I'm outlining for you here. And it is under this fourth covenant, the civil covenant, that appropriate self-defense and the Second Amendment falls. Second Amendment is a God-given right. It is not a mere feature of a constitution cooked up by some half-crazy 18th century wise guys, right? No, it is a God-given right. They articulated it. The right to self-defense, i.e. for us, the Second Amendment. We saw in some detail how the Bible requires us to defend the weak and the defenseless, to defend ourselves, our families, and to defend our communities. To roll over and say, we're commanded to love our enemies, so I must let the Muslim jihadist rape my wife, kill her and my children, and I must turn the other cheek, is not only cowardly, but it's a misunderstanding of what action is appropriate under what covenant. Determining what action is appropriate at what time requires biblical wisdom, akin to that of Solomon. You remember, Solomon says, everything, there is a season, and there is a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep, a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. So there is no absolute prescription for any particular behavior, as we see in the Anabaptist pietistic pacifist school, as they understand it, absolutizing the idea of turning the other cheek under every circumstance. It's easy, but it's a cop-out. Rather, the man of biblical wisdom knows when the appropriate time to defend himself arises and when he should turn the other cheek when persecuted. And there are times for both. The key to understanding our right to self-defense or any other act is understanding with wisdom, biblical wisdom, under which covenant we're acting. I refer you then to the entire lecture for more detail. Just understand that there is appropriate self-defense expected of you, Christian, when Islam is at our doorstep, venting their demonic jihad upon us. But individual self-defense is not the only response the Christian should have. Fourthly, the Christian must respond with appropriate cultural and societal self-defense, too. Appropriate cultural and societal self-defense. The Reformed faith is strong on the idea that Christianity has helped to shape and mold culture. Culture of the West primarily, but indeed it has. We enjoy some of the fruits and benefits of it. Just sitting in here with electric lights and a book in your hand. That's the fact that you have your Bible in your lap is a fruit of biblical wisdom and biblical efforts. Of course, who's the guy we studied in our church history course this past year who revolutionized everything in terms of having the Bible in your lap? Mr. Gutenberg, correct? So, we must respond. There is a response we must have, not only militarily, you know, defensively in that sense, but with appropriate cultural and societal defense. So don't go hide in your basement while Muslims advance what passes for culture in Islam while destroying ours. In the last 2 weeks, a Muslim smashed a church in Malmo, Sweden, and another defaced a statue in Bologna, Italy, with the words Allah Akbar. When the Imam Ahmed El-Tayyib met with the Pope recently, Pope Francis, you may recall this, he demanded that all of the statuary, the crosses, the artifacts in the Vatican be removed or covered. And this weak and vacillating Pope did just that. Do you know that Islam does not allow the human form to be represented in art? Do you know they reject all music? Islam prohibits all music. There are a few teachers and imams who dissent from this, but it's based on a Quranic verse that condemns idle talk, quote-unquote, referring to music in most of these teachers' minds. Now, I'm not saying they're just against rock and roll, but they're against all music. When the Muslim army conquered Alexandria, Egypt in 641 under the Caliph Omar was asked what should be done with all of the books in the great world-renowned library of Alexandria. And as a bibliophile, this one always infuriates me. I want to go on crusade just for this, for them having done this. Well, Omar said if these books contradict the Quran, they deserve to be burned. If they agree with the Quran, they're unnecessary. Therefore, burn them all. This is iconic of Islam's attitude toward learning and understanding the world around. It took them 6 months to burn all the books in Alexandria. But on and on we could go. All you have to do is cast your attention across the world today, too, just with your cultural eyes and your cultural caps on. We're frogs in a kettle, you know, and we're fish in a pond. We don't sense the water around us, the very environment in which we live. But a lot of it is there. We enjoy the things we enjoy. We're advanced. We've gone to the moon. We do more things than any other culture in the world. And it's in large part because of our Christian framework, Christian understanding of the world, and our approach to science and learning and understanding. We're commanded to do so by scriptures. And then compare it with the culture that you see in Islam, under Islamic countries. The rich, teeming culture society in the West and the barren, dead culture as the inheritance of Islam. They look at it, of course, as decadent, fit to be destroyed. But let me ask you, who goes to Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan or Iraq for art, food, or music? Where's the Pakistani Symphony Orchestra? if Islam has its way, you know, you like going even the Idaho Falls Symphony Orchestra or the opera that that we have from time to time. All that goes away in Islam. Where's the Pakistani Symphony? Where's the Art Institute of Saudi Arabia? Close to my heart. Can you find a bacon-wrapped goat burger in Afghanistan? Or a soup Nazi in Syria? Or do you find Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives of Iran? Is that, have you seen that on the Food Channel? Have you ever had a glass of Chardonnay or Cabernet Sauvignon from Libya? How about a fine microbrew from Kuwait? Wherever Islam predominates, it brings a culture of death in its way. It kills all of these things. It kills culture. And it is the dead culture of death they wish to bring to us as well, with the army of refugees flooding our borders. And yet cowardly, obsequious Westerners bow and scrape before stern Muslim Puritans as if these empty haters had something to offer and enrich and edify us in Islam. Americans have been so browbeaten by Muslim apologists and progressives on how America is the source of all evil, has nothing to offer the world, that we accept it as gospel. We're willing to give away the steak and the lobster we have for the gruel and goat that Islam has to offer. Even worse, Christians, who of all people should know better, retreat into their evangelical cocoons and put on their blinders and say, all we need to do is share the gospel and wait for the rapture. Cop out. The gospel applies to every area of life and culture, or to none at all. It really is time for us as Christians in the West to come to the defense of our heritage and homes. This means a literal physical defense of our borders, of our religious faith, and our national sovereignty. Islam really has ambitions to conquer the world politically, militarily, and religiously. The Quran says in Surah 61, for example, it is He, Allah, who has sent His messenger forth with the guidance and the religion of truth to make it triumph over every other religion, even though the idolaters may be averse, from the Quran, Surah number 61. It also goes on to say, it is He who has sent His messenger, that is Allah, with the guidance and religion of truth, that He may exalt it above every other religion. Allah suffices as witness, unquote, from the Quran. Other similar verses are taken by mainstream Islam as a license for world conquest. And I must say, once again, it is inspiring. It has inspired terrorists, the last two terrorist incidents here, that ISIS has arisen in Iraq and Syria. Omar Mateen pledged himself to ISIS before going on his slaughter spree in Florida. The same is true of the couple in San Bernardino. In fact, CNN reports that ISIS has either carried out or inspired over 90 attacks in 21 countries since its formation. We'll see them here, more and more, in the United States with increasing frequency, in the face of a silent and idle church. Howsoever the individual Christian responds, we as a group, as a society, must defend ourselves and our families and communities. Worldwide, we must deliberately prepare to fight on a global front Muslim aggression wherever it appears. It is time to reemploy the word crusade, however offensive it may be, to the minds of progressives and Muslims. Nationally, we must stop our suicidal trend of self-denial and refusing to call the problem what Islam, what it is. That is, its cultural, society, and military jihad upon the rest of us. The problem with Islam is Islam, okay? It is intolerant of Christ, Christianity, and the West. Wherever Muslims go in the West, they sequester themselves in Muslim ghettos and practice a culture of jihad upon their host nations. It has done so wherever it has taken root, whether in Europe or here. We must open our eyes and look about ourselves. Christian, we must defend our own cultures and way of life against this jihad. Muslims do not integrate into their host cultures. Immigration from such cultures must be stopped. A broad program of education must be launched that takes pride in Western heritage again. For too many generations, progressives have deliberately inculcated shame and disparagement of the West in general and Christianity in particular. We're losing what we once had and who we once were. The Christian church has become complicit in this. In the name of pluralism, as we even confessed in our prayer, in the name of pluralism, Christians have allowed the forces of secularism in religion, statism, listen to these three S's, secularism in religion, statism in politics, and socialism in our economy to overwhelm what we once were. Listen to the three C's that we once were. Christ as the focus of our religion, the Constitution as the focus of our political life, and capitalism as the ground of our economic life together. Tolerance, pluralism, diversity, it is the mantra of progressives. Unless it involves Christ and Christianity, all right? Then in the name of the separation of church and state, it is Christians, sit down and shut up and mind your place while we nurture these poor, misunderstood Muslims who practice the most intolerant religion on the face of the earth. Our police, security agencies, intelligence agencies must begin to protect us. They're not doing so now. The Obama administration has not protected the American people. The New York Post reports that the U.S. has experienced a major terrorist attack every year under Obama, with many more abroad. Our Constitution outlines prime directives. There are six prime directives of government, amongst which are to ensure domestic tranquility and provide for the common defense. Right now, our government is not doing that for us. The Bible insists rescue those being led away to death. Hold back those staggering towards slaughter. Prime directive of the king from Psalm 72. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the children of the needy, and crush the oppressor. Rise up, Christian, out of your slumber and learn biblical wisdom. There is a time to turn the other cheek, to love your enemy when life and actions and witness fall under the rubric of the covenant of redemption and grace. But there is also a time for the church to insist that government defend those it is commissioned to protect, to wield the sword in protection when those actions fall under the rubric of the civil covenant. And it's time for us as Christians to defend our faith and culture against Islamic jihad and insist that government defend us militarily, criminally, culturally, socially against the violence of Islamic jihad. That brings me to the end of point five. Number five, we must respond. Christians must respond to Islam with the proven solutions of history. Christians must respond to Islam with the proven solutions of history. We operate in a historical vacuum, so many of us in this culture. How pathetic the politically correct ignorance of the American people. Our either incompetent or deliberately appeasing leaders treat the problem and fashion solutions to Islam as if it were some brand new phenomenon on the world stage, right? Oh, this normally nice religion of peace has been hijacked by extremists, and we must scramble to come up with ways to cope with them while not offending the bulk of peaceful, law-abiding Muslims who mean us no harm and only want to practice Islam in an atmosphere of harmony, tolerance, diversity, and peace. Something of what we hear, isn't it? We wring our hands in great angst and assemble study committees of the best and the brightest to brainstorm strategies as if 9/11, Osama bin Laden, and Al-Qaeda and ISIS have all appeared in a historical vacuum. How foolish. We've been fighting this war with Islam for some 1,400 years. It's not a war with extremists who have hijacked an otherwise peaceful religion. It is a war with a religion whose heart, soul, and essence is that of conversion and conquest by jihad. Islam conquers by the sword, Christianity by word and sacrament, does it not? If you were told anything else, it's a lie. Whether from the mouths of Muslims who practice the doctrine of taqiyya, that is, we are the despised kafir. And it's okay. You don't lie to a Muslim, but it's okay to lie to those unclean kafir. And that word kafir is a word of despicable uncleanness in the mouth of a Muslim. And that's what we are to them, kafir. And it's okay to lie to us. Or whether those lies are the weak and silly progressives. The truth is, in this 1,400-year struggle, we in the West have found ways to successfully respond to Islam when it is waxing aggressive. waxes and wanes. We are in a waxing period now in our struggle with Islam. And one apt and pertinent example is from our own history. At the dawn of the 19th century, Muslim pirates off the Barbary coast of Africa in the Mediterranean Sea regularly, cynically raided merchant ships of the world. Funny how that's so consistent. Muhammad was a raider, and all of his disciples are raiders too. And that's exactly how they see themselves. They demanded tribute then from President Thomas Jefferson because our ships were being raided in the Mediterranean, capturing sailors, treasure, cargo. And they demanded then tribute from then President Thomas Jefferson for captured sailors and the right of American ships to pass over the waters unmolested. They were the equivalent of terrorists in our own day, only Jefferson and Adams were not politically correct in calling it what it was. They called it the predations of the Barbary Muslims. The predations of the Barbary Muslims. Yeah, they were Muslims. They were following the dictates of their faith. How did Jefferson respond? With a brand new navy at his command, much of it commissioned and built for this precise purpose. Took him a number of years, and one wag said that diplomacy is saying nice dog until you can find a big stick, right? Politics is the ability to say nice dog until you can find a big stick. And that's what they were doing. They were carrying on diplomacy while they were building the Navy. But with a brand new navy at his command, Commodore Edward Preble sailed to Tripoli, Libya, and began a campaign of blockade of the Barbary ports. And he committed raids against the Muslim cities all up and down the Barbary coast and to the shores of Tripoli. Does that sound familiar? The Marines were created for this purpose too, then, to raid the Tripolitan Empire under Hamet Karamanli. And finally, they were forced, and it's an exciting story, too. I think I saw a book downstairs on Thomas Jefferson's campaign, and a whole book on the whole thing. And it's a good read, too. But then Edward Preble, Commodore Preble, finally forced the Tripolitan ruler, Hamet Karamanli, to sign a peace treaty, returning all captured sailors, promising to leave future American shipping alone. And this happened. The war with Tripoli also intimidated the other three Muslim states in the region into leaving American shipping alone, too, as they sailed the Mediterranean. It was the first major victory for the brand new, previously untested American Navy and her Marines. So this is what Islam understands, that is, force. For the evangelical Christian to call for the turning of the other cheek or for loving our enemy, when it comes to defending the nation against an increasingly militant Islam is foolish, and I would submit sinful. It is a response Christ intended for the individual Christian and the church when confronting persecutors with the claims of the gospel. It is a response that falls under the rubric of the covenant of redemption and grace. It is not a response that a Christian government or any other government, secular or religious, should exercise when resisting current militant Islam or the cultural and military jihad of Islam. That response should issue from the dictates of the civil covenant. In that case, we should be protected and defended. Our leaders need to hear. They need to listen, and we need to speak. There is a time to speak because our government has not. They have responded rather with some of the politically correct phrases that we have dealt with. That brings me to number six. The Christian must respond to Islam with the antidote to political correctness. The Christian must respond to Islam with the antidote to political correctness. How we have been lied to, O Christian. How many more wars and bombings, terrorist attacks, threats from bearded imams proclaiming fatwas will it take before you call it what it is, normal, everyday, run-of-the-mill Islam that is now waxing? There is an agenda behind this current administration's lies about Islam. Major Hassan's slaughter of innocents at Fort Hood was labeled workplace violence. our response to Islamic Jihad, which is an integral part of the salvation of a Muslim, we call a war on terror. Deliberate attempt to call Islamic Jihad by another name. But we have dealt with some of these politically correct myths, have we not? And we need to start speaking the truth concerning them and become aware that you are being lied to, that you are being fed a line of propaganda in these things and in this regard, and to begin speaking the truth in contrariness to it. Au contraire, my dear progressive. So remember this sixfold response then. We must respond with the truth of Christ, with the love of Christ, with appropriate self-defense, with appropriate cultural and societal defense, with the proven solutions of history, and with the antidote to political correctness. So we need to, as Gideon would advise us, gird up our loins, brothers and sisters, because we're in for a long, continued, sustained conflict. And we need to face it and be prepared for it and train our children for it too, because it's been going on for 1,400 years, and it's one of the things that we face in this world yet, in this pilgrim way, as Christians. And we need to be able to face it biblically, and we need to be able to face it as Christians in defense of our home and our families and our way of life and, yea, our faith.